Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. We're talking today about drones, not the kind that may one day deliver your Amazon packages, the drones that our country uses in war. Drones were first used to deploy missiles just after 9/11 on October 7, 2001, in an unsuccessful strike on Mullah Omar, then the leader of the Taliban. In the decade and a half since then, drones have become a key tool in the arsenal of the American military and sometimes the CIA. The Obama administration has launched hundreds of strikes. By their count, they've killed about 2,500 terrorist combatants. The government says no more than 116 of those were civilians. Both of those numbers are hotly contested. Some critics say U.S. drone strikes have killed many more people than the government claims, possibly nearly 1,000 of them civilians. These numbers are at the heart of a sharp disagreement over the use of drones as weapons of war. I have two guests today with expertise on drones as weapons. Retired Air Force Lieutenant General David Deptula oversaw the first weapons use of a drone that morning, that one I mentioned, in October 2001. He went on to orchestrate the largest increase in drone operations in Air Force history. His last assignment before he retired was as the Air Force's first Deputy Chief of Staff for Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance. He's now Dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Power Studies, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to Midday, General Deptula.
Hey, thanks, Sheila. Great to be here.
I'm glad you could join us. Here with me in the studio is Hugh Gusterson, Professor of Anthropology and International Affairs at George Washington University. He is the author of a new book, Drone, Remote Control Warfare. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure, Sheila.
Glad that you are here. General Deptula, what would you say is the biggest change drones have brought to warfare?
Sheila, there are many, many changes, but I think if you point to any single change, it's the fact that drones, or more accurately termed remotely piloted aircraft, provide persistence. They provide persistence in that then yields time to observe, evaluate, and act either very quickly or take all the time necessary to be sure of a particular action in a particular area of interest.
Let me make sure I understand. When you say persistence, you're talking about the amount of time that a drone can spend in the air observing?
That's correct.
It's not about repeated visits or something like that. It's that particular operation can take as long as it needs to take.
No, that's exactly right. And quite frankly, to take it down to a more elementary level, because they're remotely piloted, there's not a human being occupying the aircraft. So now the duration that that aircraft can stay airborne is not limited by the physiological requirements of a human being.
How many people does it take to operate a drone?
Well, first, once again, drones are not ubiquitous. There are ones that can fit in the palm of your hands to those that are the size of a small airliner. But in general, the ones that I believe you're focusing on are the Predators and the Reapers, those that have been in the news recently. And nominally, it takes upwards of 200 people. That's not to actually operate it, but it is to operate it, maintain it, the associated people required to do the analysis of the information that is an output of those aircraft. So contrary to popular belief, they don't require a decrease in personnel. They actually require more personnel to effectively operate and then analyze the output of the operations.
Hugh Gusterson, you argue in your book, Drone, Remote Control Warfare, that drones are more than just a new technology. They're a paradigm shift for the U.S. military. Hey, explain that.
Well, first of all, they offer the possibility of fighting wars so asymmetrical that only the other side dies. And one can see the evident appeal of that. for U.S. military commanders and presidents and politicians. No one likes to see American troops coming back in body bags. A number of ethical philosophers and political scientists have warned that there is a danger in that feature of drone warfare, that it poses what philosophers call a moral hazard, that if all the casualties of warfare are borne by the other side, not by your own side, if war is a freebie for your side, then there's a danger that administrations become too reckless. They can wage war on the cheap and for free, if you like. So that's part of the paradigm shift.
Let me ask Lieutenant General, retired Lieutenant General Deptula to respond to that point.
It's certainly an opinion that academic philosophers can have, but it's not the reality of day-to-day operations or the conduct of military operations executed by the United States.
Well, are you saying that an asymmetrical situation where the U.S. would not have people at risk the way the enemy does? Are you saying it doesn't exist, or it wouldn't be a problem if it did exist? It would be a good thing.
The philosophical question is one that is, you know, okay, great, you can have the philosophical discussion, but the reality is, warfare is not conducted in an isolated environment. It's dirty. It involves casualties. Even in the operations against the Islamic State, the United States has suffered deaths and casualties. But the essence of the point about being able to own an asymmetric advantage is one that is to be embraced. Warfare is not about equality. It's about inflicting damage on your adversary without suffering damage yourself. And remotely piloted aircraft do provide the ability to attain that degree of asymmetry, but they're not also the only means for the conduct of warfare. So they are one tool among many. And a lot of the discussion tends to give the impression that remotely piloted aircraft or drones or unmanned aerial vehicles, whatever you'd like to call them, are out there, you know, delivering weapons the majority of the time, where that is not true. Weapons have only been used historically over the last 15 years off of drones less than 2% of the time that they operate. So, you know, if I turn that around, over 98% of the time, drones don't employ weapons at all. They're used as means to increase the situational awareness of the users, to gain greater awareness of the adversary and other areas of interest for the U.S. military.
Could I just briefly respond to that?
Yes,
I completely accept what the general is saying, that most of the time the drones are used for surveillance, for gathering intelligence, for trying to locate insurgents. It's not as if they're constantly shooting missiles every few minutes. In terms of the asymmetry, I mean, the U.S. has repeatedly attacked targets in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, even on two occasions in the Philippines. At one point in the Obama administration, the U.S. was using drones to attack targets in Pakistan on average once every 3 days. And as you mentioned, they killed thousands of people in Pakistan, and we're still not quite sure how many were civilians. But there were no American casualties from those strikes because they were done by... they were executed by people sitting in trailers in Nevada or in Virginia or elsewhere safely on U.S. soil where they couldn't be struck back. And if you're a military commander, I can readily see the appeal of that form of warfare. Now, the general said, well, philosophers can debate this, and made it sound like it's merely an academic sort of issue about the moral hazard that this encompasses. But it's not just an academic issue. It's not a philosophical issue. It's a fundamental issue for our democracy. Right. Commentators over the years have become more and more concerned about the readiness of American presidents to go to war And if you give them a form of war where they can go to war without expecting any American casualties, they will only become more eager to attack other countries, to commit operations that international lawyers see as outside the framework of international law, in contravention to international law. And there are real issues there about whether that is good for a democracy. In philosophy, this debate goes back to Immanuel Kant, who argued that democracies are inherently less likely to go to war because the people will overthrow their ruler if they keep being taken to war. Many people now worry that the situation Immanuel Kant talked about is off the table because you can go to war with no casualties if you're an American president.
So if I'm understanding your point, Hugh Gustafson, you're saying that putting aside the moral question, not mm-hmm. that anybody in this conversation is saying that's not an important question, but you're saying it essentially is bad for the United States in the world to...
It creates a temptation that presidents can't resist. So in the past, if you felt that there were insurgents in Yemen you wanted to get, you'd have to take the risk of sending special forces in there or invading. You might have to get congressional authorization. President Obama has repeatedly attacked countries without congressional authorization. On his own initiative, his lawyers have cooked up legal rationales that they've
largely not. What I'm trying to understand is, are you arguing that it is ultimately counterproductive for the U.S. in terms of its foreign policy?
Yes, I think it's counterproductive in many ways. I think it erodes democracy within the country. The people are losing control of the decision to use military force. We can talk about this later in the show, I imagine we will. But I think there are very compelling arguments to make that drone strikes have not extended American power. They've recruited personnel for our enemies. They've helped the insurgents to recruit, and that they are militarily counterproductive, and they've tarnished the American reputation. If you live inside the U.S., they look great. But if you look at opinion polls outside the U.S., overwhelming majorities of people in allied countries, Britain, France, Spain, think it's wrong to attack countries like Yemen, Pakistan with drones. They think it's against international law. It's not helping America's reputation in the world to be doing this.
General Deptula, let me get your thoughts on, in particular, the point that Hugh Gustafson just made about whether use of drones recruits more terrorist enemies and therefore just sort of ends up making the hit list of those who we feel we need to put out of commission an ever-growing list.
I think it's a ludicrous argument that there's no proof behind whatsoever. And part of that diatribe is the result of our adversaries' exquisite conduct of information operations in attempting to place so much misinformation into the environment, particularly regarding the issue of civilian casualties, that they are trying to appeal to the audiences that the professor is talking about to get the United States to place restrictions on themselves that our adversaries simply cannot accomplish physically by terminating or halting drone operations on their own. So I don't buy into in any way, shape, or form the notion of the use of drones actually creates or increases the adversary force. If you don't like drones, do you like the alternative? Do you like the occupation of hundreds of thousands of U.S. boots on the ground in a particular area? I think we saw the result of that in the last 15 years in Afghanistan and Iraq. So we have to be careful about dealing with absolutes. Warfare is not going to be conducted by remote means in any way, shape, or form, at least in our lifetimes, completely by itself.
Okay, we need to.
Drones are tools; they're not the entirety of the engagement means.
Lieutenant,
just one very brief riposte.
We need to take a quick break, and I do want to continue this, and I want to zoom in specifically on what is information and what is misinformation. We're going to continue with Hugh Gustafson, author of Drone, Remote Control Warfare, and retired Air Force Lieutenant General David Deptula. And you're welcome to join this conversation. How do you feel about the United States' increasing reliance on drones for surveillance and targeted killings? You can call us at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about drones as weapons of war. My guests are Hugh Gustafson, professor of anthropology and international affairs at George Washington University, author of a new book, Drone, Remote Control Warfare, and retired Air Force Lieutenant General David Deptula, who orchestrated the largest increase in drone operations in Air Force history. You're welcome to join this conversation if you think drones represent a new kind of warfare, or do you think this is just another step in a long line of military advances. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Hugh Gustafson, before we took the break, there was a point that you wanted to make.
Yeah, I'll be very brief, Sheila. I mean, in response to the general's claim that it's misinformation to say that drone strikes recruit more insurgents, this isn't a claim that comes from the leaders of the insurgency or from far-left activists. This is a claim that's been repeatedly made on national public radio. There have been many national public radio reports from Somalia, from Yemen, of particular instances where people on the ground have been so upset by drone strikes that killed innocent civilians that it's helped the insurgency. And a number of investigative journalists from the New York Times and the Center, to people like Jeremy Scahill, who's done some excellent work on this, have shown that the kill lists actually get longer, not shorter. The Israelis have a term for this. They call it mowing the grass. So the Israelis pioneered the use of drones to try and kill nodal opposition figures. And the way the Israelis talk about this is not that you kill a few and then the opposition collapses. They say the people you kill will be replaced and you have to kill them and then they'll be replaced and you have to kill them. And they refer to these constant waves of killing as mowing the grass. They say that you have to come back and keep mowing the grass. And that's the situation that the U.S. is moving into with drone warfare. It kills leaders who are then replaced. The Pentagon suppressed the study done by Rex Rivelo, which showed that when you kill a Taliban leader in Afghanistan, the rate of IED attacks in the vicinity of the leader you've killed actually goes up, not down, in the weeks afterwards, because the person who replaces them has something to prove. So I just want your listeners to know that there's an important argument that this is militarily counterproductive.
Well, General Deptula, I have a question, but it sounds like you're wanting to weigh in also.
Well, the fact of the matter is, where this discussion is going to is one about the question of the utility of warfare, because the points that the professor is bringing up are not unique to drones. First, drones don't define warfare. They're simply tools that are used as part of its conduct. And accordingly, they need to be regarded and employed as all other tools of war are, and that's in accordance with the laws of armed conflict and congruent with the Geneva Conventions, which the manner in which the United States is employing drones does comply with those two elements. The other point that it's very important to highlight and underlie, or actually a couple of points, generally are not reflected in media coverage, is drones are the most precise means of employing force at a distance in a way that reduces collateral damage and minimizes casualties. The second point I'd make is that drones allow for more ethical oversight than any other means of force application, principally because of that characteristic of persistence that I mentioned at the very beginning. You can take as much time as you want to develop awareness in a particular area of interest and acquire information about a particular target before you strike, even after weapons are employed. In the very, very few cases the weapons are employed through the use of drones, if the situation changes, the weapons can be directed away from the original target to avoid causing unwanted collateral damage or civilian casualties.
Let me interrupt on that point, because as you know very well, there is a lot of debate about what the civilian casualties have been. In July, the Obama administration put the number at between 64 and 116 civilians killed by drone airstrikes. In your view, that is a number that many outside non-government observers say is much too low. Too low, they say, by orders of magnitude. In your view, is that tally accurate? No more than 116 civilian deaths.
I think it's realistic. I mean, I have not looked at all of the specific data, but over the more than a decade being involved in operations with drones, remotely piloted aircraft, it's very realistic.
One of the questions...
has to recognize that, unfortunately, military combat operations do result in civilian casualties.
I think it's really
from
important.
All sources and all mediums, in the air, on the ground, and at sea. However, the fewest number of civilian casualties result from air operations, and the fewest number of aircraft systems are UAVs. I mean, and that's not me. That's, you want to quote statistics, that's from the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan, where airstrikes were cited as causing 2% of all civilian casualties. And then among airstrikes, the fewest number of civilian casualties are attributable to drones.
Let me let Hugh Gustafson in here.
First, I want to say I completely agree with the general that drones do offer an unprecedented capability to be much more discriminate in targeting. And I want to make sure your listeners know that I agree that at least in terms of capability, drones do offer that. Precisely because they can linger in the air for a long time, relay video footage to command and control centers all over the country where military lawyers can examine it and so on, there is the possibility to be much more discriminate than if you're attacking from an Apache helicopter or an F-16. But I think there's the capability drones offer, and then there's how they've been used in practice. And one of the arguments I try and make in this book is that there's been a process of what I call ethical slippage in the targeting protocol.
What does that mean?
It means that at first the U.S. started off being very fastidious in the way it selected targets on the ground. And as the insurgency got worse and worse, it loosened those protocols and became more and more desperate. And your listeners should know that there are at least two kinds of drone strikes. And often the public is given the impression that there are only what are known as personality strikes. That's where you have a list of people that are known to be insurgent leaders. You're hunting for them. When you find them, if there aren't lots of civilians around, you take the shot and you kill them. There's another kind of drone strike, the existence of which was classified until the New York Times started writing about it. Mark Mazzetti, New York Times journalist, did great work on this. And these are signature strikes where there are people on the ground, you have no idea who they are. But from the air, their behavior looks like behavior you would associate with insurgents. And they appear to be military-age males, that's the term of art, and so authorization is given to kill them. You have no idea who they are. So saying that they're civilians or insurgents can be kind of difficult. And there have been whistleblowers and dissenters within the intelligence community who have publicly complained and been quoted in the New York Times and the Washington Post, saying that they're very uncomfortable with what they call a kind of racial profiling that takes place, or a kind of profiling from the air with a very loose criteria for deciding what looks like insurgent behavior. And in terms of knowing who you've killed, I mean, I think the military gives the impression it knows a lot more than it does. The British NGO Reprieve wrote this actually morbidly funny report where they found 41 people that the U.S. announced it had killed by drone, only it had announced for each one of them that they'd been killed twice before. So these were named people who the U.S. had announced on three separate occasions for each of them that it had just killed. And I think that's pretty stunning empirical evidence that the U.S. is not really that sure who it's killing.
That is Hugh Gustafson, professor of anthropology and international affairs at George Washington University, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. With us by phone is retired Air Force Lieutenant General David Deptula, who helped shape the military's use of drones. General Deptula, let me ask you about signature strikes. From your perspective as a military person, is this the way remotely piloted vehicles ought to be used?
I'm going to pass on that subject simply because I've not been directly involved with what's been described as signature strikes.
I wonder if I might directly ask the general a question.
Please.
It's widely alleged that U.S. intelligence pays people on the ground in the tribal areas of Pakistan several thousand dollars apiece to identify insurgents and place homing devices on their cars or their homes. Is that true?
I'm not in a position to answer that question. My answers would be solely on the basis of supposition, and I'd like to stay away from speculation and talk only specifically about what I have direct knowledge of.
I would like to just say here that in a democracy, we cannot have a debate about the legitimacy of drone warfare unless the American people understand how targeting decisions are made.
The legitimacy of drone warfare is very different about the specific
tactics. We need to know how people are being
selected. The procedure of identifying a particular target and then getting intelligence to be able to more accurately employ the drone to meet the objectives of United States security policy. And what's very frustrating about these discussions is they divert attention from the fact that the adversaries that we're trying to suppress – they don't accomplish. They're not concerned with collateral damage or killing of civilians. They're involved in the massive intentional damage, intentional murder of civilians, and intentional violations of international law that have resulted in the massacre of tens and thousands of individual men, women, and children who are completely innocent. And so, you know, we're arguing about the unfortunate loss of unintentional civilian casualties on the order of, less than 100. Yet we're completely diverting the purpose of the use of drones away from attempting to stop the criminal behavior of abhorrent groups of people who relish in unvarnished murder and unspeakable crimes against humanity. So, I think we need to put the discussion in context.
General Deptula, I want to make sure I'm understanding your point, because it sounds to me as if you're saying it is illegitimate and probably serving the interests of the enemy to have a discussion about collateral damage, about civilians being killed by remotely piloted aircraft. I mean, are you saying?
Absolutely not. There's not a military planner who does not take enormous efforts and leans so far in the direction of not conducting a strike if there is any potential of killing an innocent unnecessarily. Now, when I go unnecessarily, now we get to the issue of laws of armed conflict and the issue of proportionality in terms of the use of force, where you very specifically, a decision has to be made about the proportionality of the potential collateral damage or loss of unintentional or unknown civilians relative to the military objective of the target involved. But the fact of the matter is, attention to collateral damage avoidance, quite frankly, has resulted in giving our adversaries an advantage, particularly the value of time, in which they can then therefore continue their crimes against humanity. I mean, today, it was just announced, actually I read a report today that came out of Central Command, that nominally they spend 45 to 60 days developing known targets. That's longer than the entire Desert Storm Gulf War took in its entirety, which was 43 days. Right now, we've spent over 2 years in these efforts against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And the principal reason why it's taking so long is because we're spending an unnecessarily excessive amount of time worried about collateral damage as opposed to terminating the actions of the Islamic State that ultimately are committing much greater intentional damage and loss of life to civilians than even a fraction of the use of remotely piloted aircraft against the Islamic State to get them to halt their actions.
Professor Gustafson.
I certainly wouldn't want to live under ISIS or Al-Qaeda. America is better than that, and I want to make sure America stays better than that. So I don't want to go too far down the slippery slope of the ends justifying the means and sort of writing off civilian casualties and collateral damage. It is undeniable that large numbers of civilians have been killed. We don't know how many. One instant, 70 school children at a school in Afghanistan, Pakistan on the border there, killed in a drone strike. The general said that you can divert a missile if it seems to be headed towards the wrong target. I invite him to read the memoir by Matt Martin, a drone operator, who talks about his anguish at having killed a young child and having killed an old man. After he released the weapon, he saw the child and the old man step into the frame, and there was nothing he could do. So it's not always the case that you can divert the missile. But the fundamental point, if I can go back to what I was saying before, America is supposed to be a democracy, right? When we go to war, there should be, within the reasonable bounds of national security, debates about the means that are employed and whether they are consistent with our values in the United States, and whether they are efficacious, whether they're achieving the goals that we want. The Obama administration and the Bush administration before it has been extremely secretive about the means by which it selects targets. So we can't resolve these debates about the number of civilian casualties, about the fastidious or not of targeting, unless our government is willing to share with us how it selects targets. For a long time, it kept secret the very existence of signature strikes until the New York Times forced it to come clean. The general just declined to answer some questions about how targets are selected. In a democracy, we need the answers to those questions to know how many innocent people are being killed in our name and whether this new mode of warfare really is as effective and discriminate as its proponents claim.
General Deptula, we need to take another quick break here. If you'd like to respond to that, I'll ask you to do it right after we take this break. We're talking with Hugh Gustafson, professor of anthropology and international affairs at George Washington University, and with retired Air Force Lieutenant General David Deptula, who helped shape the military's use of drones. We're talking about drones as weapons. I'm Sheila Kest. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Kast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about drones as weapons of war. Is the U.S. using them effectively? Is the U.S. using them ethically? I'm speaking with Hugh Gustafson, professor of anthropology and international affairs at George Washington University, author of a new book about drones, and retired Air Force Lieutenant General David Deptula, who helped shape the military's use of drones. And what, just before the break, General Deptula, Hugh Gustafson made several points. One of them said there had been an instance that after the trigger was pulled, a small child entered the frame and was involved, was hurt or killed in the strike. Do you want to respond to any of that?
Well, first, once again, warfare is a terrible thing. And the fact of the matter is, unfortunately, combat operations result in unintentional civilian casualties. But we go out of our way in the United States to do everything we possibly can to avoid situations like that. There are individual instances. I'm not taking the point that there have been no civilian casualties or unintentional civilian casualties caused by the use of weapons in warfare. But the use of drones allow for highest degree of accuracy, and they have resulted, and these aren't my statistics, but they're the UN statistics, in the least number of civilian casualties relative to all the other modalities of warfare.
Help me.
The second point I wanted to make real quick, if I may, Sheila,
sure,
is I didn't refuse to answer how we do targeting. I refuse to confirm or deny a particular specific intelligence method that you wanted me to identify. I can talk to you about for hours on how we conduct targeting. And the target study and evaluation and knowledge development and means of attack, adjusting fusing timing, of adjusting explosive capacity to minimize potential collateral damage is one of the most significant elements that go into target planning.
Can I ask you then the general question, does the U.S. ever outsource the choice of targets to other countries?
No.
Okay.
The New York Times disputes that.
The New York Times doesn't conduct warfare.
Well, that's an interesting thought also. But let me ask you what is seems to me sort of a parallel question that's not about targets but about assessing who has been injured. I have read that the United States essentially after a remotely piloted strike counts men of military age, young men of military age, as insurgents if they were killed or hurt by the drone without, again, it's parallel in terms of not knowing precisely who they were. They may not have been targets of the original action, but they're not counted as civilian deaths if they're of military age. Is that accurate, General Dreptula?
Well, I think what you're raising, Sheila, is a very good point, and that's how one defines a civilian. If you look at some of the, it's interesting that in the northern Waziristan area of Pakistan, the Pakistani Air Force has conducted thousands of strikes, and you'll read nothing in the Pakistani press about innocent civilians being killed by the Pakistani military. Well, part of that is because they define anybody who lives within 50 kilometers of a known terrorist outpost as terrorists. So your definitions are important, and how one counts individuals in a particular area is very, very specific to the particular action that one's referring to. So,
okay, but
making a sweeping generalization it really isn't helpful to this discussion.
Well, are you saying that what I have read about counting as insurgents any man killed in a drone strike who is of military age, that is too sweeping a generalization?
I would have to go to your source. I'm not familiar with, that particular metric. So, I'm happy to comment on something I have specific knowledge about, I'm just simply not familiar with with that attribution.
I'll just throw in an interesting little anecdote here that General Stanley McChrystal, who's very ambivalent about drone warfare, actually banned the use of the term military age male at one point because he thought that it sort of gave too much permission to people to strike anyone who fit that profile.
I'd like to talk to Frank, who has called us from Aberdeen. Frank, welcome to Midday.
Yes. Am I on?
You are on the air, Frank.
Okay, first of all, I want to commend the general for being very careful to keep classified information out of his speaking. But the thing I want to, the one thing that just comes to mind is during Vietnam, any Vietnamese killed was classified as VC. Mm-hmm. Secondly, Congress has just passed overwhelmingly a bill that will allow 9/11 people to sue Saudi Arabia, which will make us now liable for at least 116 deaths. And the whole basis of all this drone warfare is under question because it's all based on the 60 words used to authorize force against al-Qaeda. A lot of these people are not al-Qaeda. Thank you.
Frank, thank you for the questions. General Dreptula, can you respond to Frank?
I'm recounting his points.
Particular on the point that should we be expecting that the United States needs to compensate at least those whom we acknowledge to be civilian casualties of drones?
I'm not going to get into the issue of policy on what the United States government is going to do or not. I'm happy to talk about the characteristics of remotely piloted aircraft and how they provide the United States an exquisite tool to allow us to progress against our war against terrorism. But I don't want to get into political issues.
Do you, Professor Gusterson?
I'd like to respond to a different element in Frank's comment, which I found very useful and interesting. He brought up the issue of the Vietnam War, and we haven't discussed Vietnam before now, but I think counterinsurgency campaigns in the current moment are haunted by the ghost of Vietnam. I know General Dreptula wrote a very forceful op-ed in the Washington Post last year saying that the U.S. could have won in Vietnam if the Air Force had been allowed to prosecute the war from the air more aggressively. I think that's a fundamental question of whether counterinsurgency campaigns can be won at all, and whether air power can do it, whether there are, if you like, magic weapons which, if unleashed, will finally defeat insurgencies on the ground. I suspect General Deptula and I have a fundamental disagreement about this. There have been very few insurgency campaigns that have been defeated by foreign occupying powers. Britain and Ireland lost. Kenya, British lost. Afghanistan, the Russians lost. Iraq, the Americans effectively lost. Vietnam, the French and the Americans lost. There's always this fantasy that there's the magic weapon that will enable us to win this time when we lost last time. To me, that's what Frank brought up.
General Deptula.
Yeah, well, actually, Professor, I think you'll find this kind of maybe surprising, but I'm not going to disagree with you because I don't believe in magic weapons, and I don't believe that one can accomplish objectives solely by the use of one medium of warfare. What I do believe is that the use of force needs to be part of a well-defined and thought-out strategy that clearly delineates what the desired outcomes of the particular military action should be. And then the tools that are available should be used in a way to rapidly accomplish the operational level objectives that feed directly into the desired strategic outcomes. This is my problem with the current operations that are being conducted against the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. One has to clearly define what are the critical U.S. national security interests that are involved. And I would suggest to you that it's not the resolution of the Sunni-Shia conflict. That's been going on for 14 centuries. It's not simply the maintenance or regaining the sovereignty of Iraq, but it is, in fact, eliminating the Islamic State's ability to have a sanctuary from which they can export terror to the United States and the rest of the world. And then to be able to get to the heart of accomplishing that U.S. interest, one needs to be much, much more coherent and rapid in fundamentally attacking those elements of the Islamic State that allow them to continue their behavior. It's not going to solve the entire problem, but it could have certainly terminated their ability to create the mischief that has resulted from their actions around the world over the last 2 years. But I digress a bit. But there is no wonder weapon. War can't be won by just one modality. It's about using right force, right place, right time to meet specific and clear objectives.
Could I ask the general a question? What counterinsurgency campaign do you look to, General, that you see as a success, that you look to for inspiration?
Well, first, I would tell you that the operations that we're currently involved in are mischaracterized as a counterinsurgency. The Islamic State's not a counterinsurgency. They're a state, and they have all the elements that make up a state that can be acted upon to be terminated very, very quickly that would reduce their ability to export terrorism and create the kind of conditions that have resulted over us allowing them to continue to operate for 2 years.
We have just a half minute left. I'll give it to you, Professor Gusterson. Is there something, is a point you'd like to make to wrap up?
My final point is just that it's very hard to find an example of a foreign power engaged in a counterinsurgency campaign that succeeded. Al-Qaeda is not a state. The Taliban are not a state. And we're not making headway. We're losing ground.
You have both given us a lot to think about, drones. There's lots more I wish I could have asked you, but I am grateful to you both for this hour. Retired Air Force Lieutenant General David Deptula, Dean of the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Power Studies, orchestrated the largest increase in drone operations in Air Force history. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks, Sheila, and thanks, Hugh.
Thank you, General, and thank you, Sheila.
And Hugh Gusterson, Professor of Anthropology and International Affairs at George Washington University, author of Drone, Remote Control Warfare. Thank you so much. Lunch today provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop on the Avenue in Hampden, offering a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. This Saturday, 2 p.m., they're offering a Taste of Normandy class, including mussels and balsamic roasted vegetables. More on the web at Baltimore Chef Shop. shop.com. Thank you for listening. You may have heard some changes coming to your ears on WYPR. Starting next week, Tom Hall will be here with you at noon, hosting midday, and I'll be starting a new show, a new interview show in the mornings called On the Record, 9:30 weekday mornings. We intend to zero in on questions that are important to our region, state, country, and talk to people touched by change or making change happen. I hope you'll check us out. On the Record debuts Monday morning, 9:30. Meanwhile, tune in tomorrow at noon here on Midday. We'll be looking at school discipline. Minority students are far more likely than whites to be suspended, and being suspended multiple times is linked to dropping out, a closer indicator even than failing grades. We'll discuss the impact of zero-tolerance discipline policies and why critics believe suspensions fuel the school-to-prison pipeline. That's tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.